Production. Recorded live.
And I heard another voice from heaven saying, Come out of her, my people, that ye be not partakers of her sins, and that ye receive not of her plagues. For her sins have reached unto heaven, and God hath remembered her iniquities. Fellow Adamites, we are seeing the cracks emerge in Babylon. We are seeing the cracks spread. I don't believe it will be too long now before we hear, Babylon the Great is fallen, is fallen. And Yahweh willing, we shall all be there to witness it, and all the world shall bear witness to the power of Yahweh. If you have not begun to prepare for the things which are to come, the things which you're already starting to see happen, then you'd best do so now. Now is the time to make preparations, gather supplies, make plans, and focus your efforts to keep on the straight and narrow path. Be right with the Heavenly Father, and He shall bring you through the plagues that await this doomed nation. Today is Sunday, July 17, 2011, and Bill Fink is with us again for the third installment of the Great Sedition Trials series. How are you doing tonight, sir?
Hello, praise Yahweh.
Absolutely, praise Yahweh. And just to give a brief recap, we've set the stage by revealing that the purpose of these trials aimed at the patriots that wanted isolationism, and they wanted America to avoid involvement in these foreign wars that had nothing to do with America. The main reason was to intimidate the little man on the street to make him think, if I hold these views or articulate these views, I'm going to wind up on trial and they're going to derail me and ruin my life and drag me into the court for 2 years. They didn't want to go after the big ticket guys like Coughlin and Charles Lindbergh because those names were, they had too much celebrity status. They didn't want to bring attention to the people. They just wanted to crush dissent.
Well, right. There were larger voices like Senator Nye and Taft. And they were against the war, and that their sympathies were with the America First Committee and the constitutional position of what our government should have been. And it silenced them. It silenced them because they were afraid of how far. Well, they still voiced opposition, but Lindbergh and Coughlin, and there were other reasons why they silenced Coughlin also, and we'll talk about those. But those men may have been, and others like them, may have been a lot more vocal, but the sedition trial actually put a lot of the Roosevelt opposition into a state of fear, because nobody wants to be tied up fighting a government case for a year or 2 years or 3 years. We see with this sedition trial, there were actually three indictments, and each indictment was of a rather large group, but in the second indictment, they added some people, and then in the third indictment, they dropped a lot of people that were in the first two indictments.
Hmm.
And some of the people that they picked on were helpless, older people that didn't have a lot of money and that really couldn't defend themselves. We saw the one 83-year-old man from Nebraska died hammering out his defense on a typewriter, right?
Exactly. And Attorney General Francis Biddle, we've covered him. He was the guy, the main presiding judge at Nuremberg. And he had to have been just a ruthless, amoral careerist who was a coward, a moral coward and probably a physical coward, because he protested the Japanese-American internment. He protested all sorts of Roosevelt policies, but he never did anything about it. He just said, oh, I'm against that. Well, if you're really against something and you think it's an atrocity, as you said, if you're a public official, you publicly resign. And when all the papers come to ask, you know, well, you're the attorney general for the whole country, why are you resigning? You cast light on the atrocity. He didn't do that.
Well, Francis Biddle was in a position to cast light on the atrocity by resigning. That is what noble men do. That is what noble army officers and noble statesmen do when they're forced to take action that runs against or contrary to their principles. The noble thing to do is to resign, and that shows the public that the action which they resigned in order to prevent having to undertake truly is a nefarious action. That shines the light and on the administration itself and on the president. And if Francis Biddle resigned, it may have helped the cause of these people who were being tried unfairly, indicted unfairly in this sedition trial.
I don't know if these are his views or if this is a wiki, but wiki says, during World War II, he, meaning Biddle, used the Espionage Act to attempt to shut down, quote, vermin publications, quote, including Father Coughlin's publication entitled Social Justice. Now, I don't know if that's just some Jew who edited Jewikipedia and wrote vermin publications, or if Biddle actually referred to Social Justice as a vermin publication. But if he actually called it a vermin publication, that'd be pretty telling about where his loyalty lied.
Well, absolutely, and that might be some. We might want to look into that a little further when we cover Coughlin. Hopefully, the coming up here soon, right?
And you know, Biddle, he had no problem sitting down next to Iona Nikitchenko. That was the Soviet judge at Nuremberg who presided over all the show trials in the 30s. And to think that, you know, a French judge, a British judge, and an American judge were fine sitting down next to this guy. I wouldn't want to share a bench with someone like that.
Well, no, absolutely not. But it shows the way the Roosevelt administration, a great number of them, thought. And I think that we elucidated that, at least in part, with the Traitor series, that these men, a lot of these men, were just naturally communists. And they really didn't think that there was anything wrong with hobnobbing, with this gang of crooks and criminals that had usurped the Russian Empire, that they really didn't think there was anything wrong with that. They thought they were doing the right thing, especially men like Harry Hopkins.
So if they'd have been around 150, 160 years earlier, they'd have thought everything that Robespierre and Marat were doing in France was A-OK. They'd say, oh, those guys are standing up for France.
Well, absolutely.
All right, would you like to begin where we left off on the trial?
I made a quote from my Philadelphia article, right? And I kind of like it, right? It basically says that with Jeffersonian liberalism believed that a God-fearing people could govern themselves and therefore be free of tyrants, and Jewish liberalism removes God from the people and creates a tyranny that the tyrants of the past could only envy, right? I mean, it's Jeffersonian liberalism and the liberalism that we've been sold on by these Jews that's really Bolshevism. It's really Talmudic Bolshevism. It is that they're worlds apart. It's incredible how different they are. And people have no problem with taking that same term and applying it to two absolutely contrary ideologies. It's incredible. And they do it without even thinking.
They think we're so free today, and freedom to them, they think it means that they're free to say anything they want in terms of how offensive or obscene it may be, but they don't really have much ideological freedom. I mean, you can walk down the street uttering swear words and blaspheming and profaning God. Sure, no one will object to that, but if you want to stand on the street corner and talk about Jewish power, you might be arrested pretty quickly.
No
and
doubt.
I think that's what free speech is really about. It means the freedom to articulate an ideological opinion that may be at odds with the state or that may be at odds with mainstream prevailing thought.
Well, that's why that's why speech is protected by the Bill of Rights. That's why the men that insisted that the Bill of Rights be included in the Constitution had that first article in there about free speech, because that article is not that's a God-given right. Okay, if you read the scripture, there's a word that the King James translates very often as boldness, and that word is the Greek word parrhesia, and the Greek word parrhesia means freedom of speech in every aspect that we use the term, and that's what it is, and I don't know why the King James chose such a weak translation, probably because the entire translation is just meant to uphold the authority of the Anglican Church. I mean, the King James translation is terrible in many respects because they chose language which appeared to give the Anglican Church its authority over the people, when in fact, in Christianity, only Christ has authority over the people. Well, parrhesia is the term that the Greeks used to encapsulate that idea of freedom of speech, which we believe that we have as a God-given right. And that was a Christian precept that we have freedom of speech before God, and that no man could take that away from us. And the founders built that into the Bill of Rights, without a doubt, with that very same Christian principle in mind, that no man can stop us from telling the truth and speaking things that make others feel uncomfortable. And that is anathema to the Jew, who wants to control our speech, who wants to dictate what we should think and what we shouldn't think in order to make the world safe for his crime ring, which is the world's oldest crime ring, right? That's basically what it's about. And freedom of speech is something that we should never, that there is never, ever any reason at all to put any infringement at all on anybody's speech. As soon as we do that, as soon as we have that thinking in our minds that we can infringe on another one's speech no matter what they're saying, then we cede our own right to free speech. None of us deserve any of our rights, because free speech, like the right to keep and bear arms, comes from God. When you want to cede your rights for any reason whatsoever, when you want to cede anybody else's rights for any, or infringe on anybody's rights, God-given rights, for any reason whatsoever, you don't deserve your own. That's why our rights are being violated in our own nation, because we came up with, we fell for this idea that we should infringe on the rights of others if we don't agree with how they employ those rights. And we don't deserve our own rights once we do that.
We saw that happen in Alabama, where all those people that are against God and against the Ten Commandments, they say, oh, that judge has no right to have that statue with the Ten Commandments.
Well, right, and that judge has every right to have that statue. And no, if you don't like it, that's tough.
Don't look at it.
The principle to freedom of speech is that, we all have the right to speak our mind before God and government. And even if I don't like what you're saying, I had better defend your right to say it, or I'll lose my own right to speak my own mind. The freedom of the First Amendment is created to protect hate speech. It's created to protect hate speech. Hate speech is not excluded by it. Nobody has to protect nice speech. Nice speech doesn't need a.
Everybody likes nice speech.
Of course, the apostles weren't slain because they were preaching peace, love, and joy. Nobody has to protect niceties.
If you tell people to obey the emperor,
don't think in this world.
The emperor is not going to slay you if you tell people to obey the emperor and that the emperor is God.
Well, it's absolutely incredible how the Jew can deceive people time and time again into ceding their own God-given rights. And once you think that a man could take your God-given rights away, yeah, you don't deserve any rights. If you won't stand up for your rights, and the founders perceived our rights as coming from God, and that's a concept that leads one to believe that if your rights come from God, man cannot take them away. Government cannot take them away because they didn't give you that right. If that right comes from God, no man can separate it from you. And if you believe that, then you'll stand up for your rights. People forgot that, and they don't stand up for their rights. People believe these rights come from the government. A lot of the typical men in the street believe that their right to keep and bear arms, their right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, their right to speech, their right to vote, they believe these rights come from the government. It's absolutely incredible. And if the government takes them away, that they shrug and grumble, but they should be marching on Washington with pitchforks and scythes.
Well, that should have happened in 1913. It should have happened in 1917. It should have happened in 1932, 1934.
It should have really happened in 1861.
Well, it almost did. I mean, look what happened in Baltimore. Lincoln had to call out the Federals to arrest the Maryland state legislature because they were going to vote to secede, and he put Baltimore under martial law.
And when the army went along with Lincoln, they should have never imposed that. They should have never followed those orders. That's another case where there should have been massive resignations.
And if I recall, too, they had martial law in a lot of cities. Cincinnati, Ohio was under martial law for the entire length of the war. They were afraid that there were so many Confederate sympathizers, they thought they would rise up and seize the city.
Well, it goes to show you how many of us care for our bellies more than for our freedoms.
But you would think a government should assume if there are that many people that support the other side, maybe something's wrong with the position the government has, as opposed to, oh, something's wrong with all these people. We need to put them on trial for sedition.
Well, okay, we've been talking about we've been covering the discourses of David Baxter and Lawrence Dennis, who were defendants themselves in the sedition trials. And we've been giving their assessments of what was going on and how they described other defendants. And right now we're in the middle of Lawrence Dennis's description of defendant Eugene Sanctuary, who actually had a Jewish lawyer, right? And Eugene Sanctuary was actually a patriot. He wrote patriotic songs. There's no way this man wanted to overthrow the United States government or turn the United States military against the government. But it just shows you that the sedition trials are a perfect example of the lengths the Jew will go to perpetrate his crimes and to crush opposition that's supposed to be political. And in a nation where there's supposed to be an open political discourse and where people are supposed to have the God-given right to criticize their government. And that's that our liberties depend upon the people standing up for those rights. People don't stand up for those rights anymore. They don't deserve them. They deserve the slavery that we've come to endure. And don't forget. Don't think for one minute that when the government's taken half of your income in taxes, at least, that you're not a slave. And when you can find no land to live on without paying some sort of tax, you are indeed a slave. Lawrence Dennis's assessment of the government's case is reminiscent of that of Kirkpatrick Dilling. Quote, "The pattern of the prosecution gradually emerged something like this. Our country is at war. Russia is our ally. The Russian government is communist. These defendants fight communism. They are therefore weakening the ties between the two countries. This is interfering with the war efforts. This is in turn injuring the morale of the armed forces." Of course, it's all feigned, right? This entire prosecution is a scheme. "The indictees should therefore be sent to prison." Henry H. Klein, an outspoken Jewish anti-communist, as if there could really be such a thing, was the attorney who represented defendant Eugene Sanctuary, and he took issue with the very constitutionality of the trial. "The alleged indictments," under Klein in his opening address to the jury, "is under the peacetime statute, not under the Wartime Act, and the writings and speeches of these defendants were made when this nation was at peace and under a constitution which guarantees free press and free speech at all times, including during wartime, until the Constitution is suspended." Well, guess what? "And it has not yet been suspended," or so he thought. "These people believe in the guarantee set forth in the Constitution, and they criticized various acts of the administration." About his own client, Klein noted, this is about Eugene Sanctuary, "He is 73 years old and devoutly religious. He and his wife ran the Presbyterian Foreign Mission Office in New York City for many years, and he has written and published several hundred sacred and patriotic songs. One of these songs," Klein noted, was, quote, "Uncle Sam, We Are Standing By You," and was published in June of 1942, well after the war had begun. Hardly the actions of the dangerous seditionist that the prosecution and the sympathetic press painted Sanctuary to be. As far as Lawrence Dennis's purported sedition was concerned, the prosecution had attempted to prove its case exclusively by placing in evidence seven excerpts from his public writings, reprinted in the publication of the German-American Bund, rather than as originally published. In other words, the evidence that Dennis had committed sedition was because he had written something, which was published and freely available to the public, that later was reprinted by a group sympathetic to Nazi Germany, not that Dennis himself had actively done anything to stir dissension among the American armed forces.
You can't be responsible for who takes your work and republishes it.
Well, according to the Roosevelt administration, I guess you have to be.
Well, I'm sure things that people in Roosevelt's administration had written wound up in communist journals, and I'm sure in those cases they actually wrote those explicitly for those journals. But that's basically the equivalent of saying that if I write an essay my junior year in college and 10 years later somebody appropriates it and sticks it in some newsletter, I'm somehow responsible for that. That's absurd.
According to Lawrence Dennis, quote, the government's prosecution theory said, in effect, we postulate a world conspiracy, the members of which all conspire to Nazify the entire world by using unlawful means of undermining the loyalty of the armed forces. That this is, you know, we see the same wild accusations against their political opponents coming out today all the time from the Southern Poverty Law Center, from the Anti-Defamation League. They're always making these broad slanders in order to stifle their political opposition. And what the general public doesn't understand is that the Anti-Defamation League is a religious organization which is part of a secret society. B'nai B'rith is the Masonic, it's the Jewish arm of Masonry, the open Jewish arm of Masonry, right? And people don't understand that the ADL at B'nai B'rith is a religious organization that's part of a secret society, and they have become the de facto suppliers of information to all government and law enforcement in this country regarding matters of religion. Jewish organization is part of a secret society. Imagine that.
Let me just read briefly, real quick, on B'nai B'rith from Wikipedia. Initially founded in 1843 by Henry Jones and 11 others, that couldn't have been his birth name, it was known as the Independent Order of B'nai B'rith. B'nai B'rith is engaged in a wide variety of community service and welfare activities, including the promotion of Jewish rights, promoting the State of Israel, assisting hospitals and victims of natural disasters, awarding scholarships to Jewish college students, sponsoring low-income senior housing, and opposing anti-Semitism through its Center for Human Rights and Public Policy. With nearly 100,000 members and supporters, B'nai B'rith International reaches more than 50 countries around the world to increase the welfare of resident Jews. So it's an international Jewish secret fraternity founded along Masonic lines.
Well, the ADL is basically the modern public relations agency for the world's oldest crime ring.
In 1913, the B'nai B'rith founded the Anti-Defamation League in direct response to the trial and lynching of Leo Frank, a B'nai B'rith member. Fancy that. He was in B'nai B'rith. How fun.
Yeah, they like to molest and rape young white women.
Well, rape and kill. And they have a B'nai B'rith youth organization, B'nai B'rith Girls, and it doesn't look like they have a B'nai B'rith Boys.
Okay, the government's prosecution theory said, in effect, this is according to Lawrence Dennis, we postulate a world conspiracy, the members of which all conspired to Nazify the entire world by using the unlawful means of undermining the loyalty of the armed forces. Now, we've seen that most of these people didn't even know each other, right? And had never met. We ask the jury to infer the existence of such a conspiracy from such evidence as we shall submit about the Nazis, simply because they had similar political ideologies that, according to the government, made these people part of this grand conspiracy. It's like the Democrats charging three men of being part of a great conspiracy because they're Republicans, right? Oh, well, they're all Republicans, and all Republicans are part of this conspiracy against us. that this is crazy that people fall for this trash. We shall then ask the jury to infer that the defendants joined this conspiracy from the nature of the things they said and did. We do not need to show that the defendants ever did or said anything that directly constituted the crime of impairing the morale or loyalty of the armed forces. In other words, it wasn't necessary that they actually broke the law, right? Our thesis is that Nazism was a world movement which, by definition, was also a conspiracy to undermine the loyalty of the armed forces, and that the defendants were members of the Nazi world movement. There was no more reason to bring out in a charge of conspiracy to cause military insubordination the facts that most of the defendants were anti-Semites, isolationists, or anti-communists than there would have been in a trial of a group of New York City contractors on a charge of conspiring to defraud the city to bring out the facts that the defendants were all Irish or Jews and had always voted the Democratic ticket. In other words, the indictment being for the charges of insubordination of the armed forces, the fact that the defendants may have been anti-Semites or Nazis or it had nothing to do with the charge, right?
So they would have us believe that some farmer from Oklahoma and a bricklayer from Detroit are Nazi agents who were recruited by the Abwehr and are working for the German government.
Well, right. And if they were really agents, that they'd be I don't want to say attractive, that they'd be young Jewish college students working for congressmen, that like Gary Condrat and Chandra Levi, right?
And I assume that if you're an agent for a foreign government, you're not going to be living on a farm in Oklahoma. You'll probably be in New York City, Los Angeles, Chicago, Baltimore, Boston.
You're not going to conquer the United States from a farm in Nebraska, right? That's just not going to happen. Eugene Sanctuary's attorney, Henry Klein, pulled no punches when he laid out the defense, declaring, "We will prove that this persecution and prosecution was undertaken to cover the crimes of the government. Remember that. We will prove that it was undertaken by order of the president in spite of the opposition of the Attorney General Biddle. We will prove that Mr. Rogue," that now Rogue was the he's the new prosecutor in this case, and he is a straight communist, right? He's an avowed communist. He visited the Soviet Union, and there's no doubt that this man is 100% sympathetic to the communist cause. We will prove that Mr. Rogue was selected for his job of punishing these defendants because no one else in the Department of Justice felt that he could find sufficient grounds in which to spell out a crime against these defendants. So Rogue got the job because he was a communist and he was the only one that wanted to hang these people, right?
So he was probably banned in his job. He volunteered.
Right, simply for their political persuasion. We will prove that the communists control not only our government, but our politics, our labor organizations, our agriculture, our mines, our industries, our war plants, and our armed encampments. This is a Jew saying this in 1944, right? And McCarthy said it 7 years later, and he was slandered, right? Well, it was absolutely true, and McCarthy was right, right? We will prove that the law under which these defendants are being tried was enacted at the repeated demands of the heads of our armed forces to prevent communists from destroying the morale of our soldiers, sailors, marines, and air forces, didn't stop them in the 60s, and that this prosecution was undertaken to protect communists who were and are guilty of the very crimes charged against these defendants who are utterly innocent and have been made the victims of this law. Klein minced no words when he told the jury that Jewish organizations were using the trial for their own ends. What else is new? We will prove that this persecution was instigated by so-called professional Jews. Now, this is a Jewish lawyer speaking, right?
Why do these patriots always go into court with a Jewish attorney? Do they think if they have a Jewish attorney, he's really going to go to bat for them and he's going to earn the money?
You know, I'm going to be frank, right? Because I went through this in a different way, in a different time, for different reasons. And I had a Jewish lawyer at first because I thought that if you wanted to fight with the devil, the best thing to do was to hire one. Of course, that was before I knew anything, and I was in my 30s, and I thought I was doing the right thing. I learned very quickly that I made a large mistake. That's the way it is. But that's, you know, the lack of education in this country is astounding.
The idea that a Jewish lawyer will be particularly vicious on your behalf. Well, he'll be vicious, but it may not be on your behalf.
Well, absolutely. He'll be vicious on your behalf. He will. He'll put on a good act, but he's making his backroom deals all the time. And everything that he does in public is show. Klein missed no words when he told the jury that Jewish organizations were using the trial for their own ends. We will prove that this persecution was instigated by so-called professional Jews who make a business of preying on other Jews by scaring them into the belief that their lives and their property are in danger through threatened pogroms in the United States. This is still going on. It's rabbis that paint most
pogroms
of the swastika
in the United States.
Synagogues. And their property are in danger through threatened pogroms in the United States, and the anti-Semitism charged in the so-called indictment is a racket that is being run by racketeers for graft purposes. That's a Jewish lawyer speaking. And I have a video. It's in my Philadelphia article. It's from I think a Russian news service, and it has a Jewish woman stating that charges of anti-Semitism are basically a scam that the Jews pull on Americans, and very successfully.
Oh, I've seen that, but that was part of the prosecution's argument, that these people, in arguing against American involvement in the war, were advocating and articulating views that would lead to pogroms against Jews in America.
Well, absolutely. That's the assumption, but that's exactly what a lot of the Jews were saying. Anybody who was against the war, anybody who was anti-communist, was basically a Nazi. We see it today all the time. I mean, I've seen it on YouTube 50 times, that the Jews label anybody that professes to be a Christian is labeled a Nazi. Why? Because most Christians dislike sexual deviance. If you dislike sexual deviance, you're an evil, racist Nazi. Most Jews happen, or most sexual deviants happen to be Jews. And most Jews happen to be very sympathetic to sexual deviance. I wonder why. Klein minced no words when he told the jury that Jewish organizations were using the trial for their own ends. I'm sorry, I read that already. Klein also forcefully made the allegation that FBI agents had been acting as agents provocateurs, attempting to stir up acts of sedition. We see that happen all the time. Remember Ruby Ridge, right? We will show that the most vicious written attack on Jews and on the Roosevelt administration emanated from the office of the FBI by one of its agents, and that the purpose of this attack was to provoke others to do likewise. Agent, it's a very old trick, the provocateur's trick. We will show that this agent also drilled his underlings in New York with broomsticks preparatory to, quote-unquote, killing Jews. Klein also put forth a rather interesting allegation about the source of certain funds purportedly supplied by Nazi Germany to no less than Franklin D. Roosevelt himself. According to Klein, we will show that large sums of Hitler money helped finance Mr. Roosevelt's campaign for re-election in 1936. At this moment, British, American, and German capital and industry are cooperating together in South America and other parts of the world. What Klein alleged about international collaboration of high finance capitalism has been part of the lore, L-O-R-E, of the populist right and the populist left for over a century, and is a theme that has been analyzed in scores of books, monographs, and other literature, but largely ignored in the so-called academic mainstream. According to Lawrence Riley's account of the sedition trial, Klein's speech was a critical turning point in the defense. Klein did much in his brief speech to torpedo Rogue's case by bringing to light the hidden agencies responsible for its existence. However, noted Riley, even many of the daily newspapers which opposed the trial editorially were afraid to discuss the hidden aspect of the case that Klein had dared bring forth in open court. Riley said that readers were often left confused because the papers never touched on the real factors involved. No surprise. Some of these friendly papers, Riley noted, insisted on referring to the defendants as crackpots. They must be if they don't like Jews. But the fact is that, as a direct consequence...
prosecution papers, these are actual court documents?
Well, he's talking about the papers not properly representing the court documents.
Oh, okay.
And the actual statements that were made in their articles, that they avoided the statements concerning Jews that Klein had made, which left the defendants confused, which left their readers confused because they weren't getting the whole story.
As to what these people said that would make them crackpots.
Well, as to what these people said that would discredit the prosecution's case also. But the fact is that, as a direct consequence of his offensive against the ADL and the other Jewish groups that had played a part in orchestrating the trial, Klein was targeted specifically because he was Jewish by organized Jewish groups that resented Klein's defense of the purported anti-Semites and seditionists. For his own part, Lawrence Dennis stood up in court to take on his own defense and delivered what even liberal writer Charles Higham was inclined to acknowledge was a high-powered address, calling Rogue's outline, Rogue being the prosecutor, calling Rogue's outline of the government case corny, false, fantastic, untrue, unprovable, and unsound, and describing the trial as a Roosevelt administration fourth-term conspiracy and another Dreyfus case in which the government was trying to write history in the heat of battle. To the loud applause of his fellow defendants, Dennis declared Pearl Harbor did not suspend the Bill of Rights. A critical juncture in the case came when one of the defense attorneys, James Laughlin, who was a public defender representing Defendant Ernest Elmhurst, said in open court that it would be impossible for the trial to continue unless the private files of the Anti-Defamation League of B'nai B'rith could be impounded and introduced as evidence.
And that'll never happen.
Right, it will never happen. It was clear that much of the prosecution...
About the ADL, if I recall correctly, the police conducted a raid against the ADL in the late 80s, early 90s, I think their San Diego and their San Francisco offices, and they found that the ADL had tens of thousands of stolen police documents, and they also had documents on anti-apartheid activists, since at the time the Israelis had a friendly policy towards the South Africans, so they were working with them.
That might be that might be good fodder to illuminate one night, because I'm not acquainted with it.
So the ADL was basically at the behest of Mossad. They were keeping tabs on anti-South African apartheid activists in the United States, mainly on the West Coast and East Coast.
Well, the ADL is a public relations firm for Jewry, and anybody that opposes any plank of the Jewish agenda is going to come under fire from the ADL and the SPLC and all of the other Jewish groups. And you don't have to talk about Jews. Jews don't even have to be involved. If you're opposing the integrationist Jewish agenda, political agenda, you will come under their purview. And if you're at all effective in your opposition, if you have any sort of voice in the community, they will try to take you down.
Interestingly, though, I thought, you know, the Jews are against segregation and they're against apartheid, but when Israel's getting uranium and other nuclear materials from South Africa, somehow they're in favor of South Africa. That seems awful convenient, doesn't it?
Well, absolutely. It was clear that much of the prosecution was based on the ADL's fact-finding, quote-unquote, and Laughlin concluded that it would be necessary to determine precisely what the ADL had provided the government if the defendants would be able to put on an effective defense. The judge seemed prepared to ignore Laughlin's motion, but the clever attorney had already prepared copies of his motion in advance and distributed copies of the motion to the press. As a direct consequence, Washington newspapers reported that the ABL files had been made an issue in the case. As Riley summarized the situation, Laughlin had placed the spotlight upon the big secret of the case. This, according to Riley, was a bomb which, some have said, had more to do with demoralizing the prosecution's case than any other single factor. At that point, there seemed to be a strange turnabout in the way that the press supporting the trial began looking at the case. Even the Washington Post, which had played a part in orchestrating the trial by lending the services of its reporter, Dillard Stokes, to the joint ADL-FBI investigation, completely reversed itself, according to Riley, and started demanding that the case be brought to a quick conclusion because nobody would want the ADL to have to turn over their files, and that would become part of the record of the trial, right? That the when I read this, it really reminded me of the Washington Post's role in the fall of Richard Nixon, and I wonder how much of that wasn't part of a conspiracy against Nixon. And it's because most of that, the public trial and prosecution of Richard Nixon that occurred in 1974, what was all at the instigation of a couple of Jewish reporters at the Washington Post.
It was all media contrived too.
Well, absolutely. Well, at least Bernstein was a Jew. I don't know about Woodward, but if Woodward wasn't a Jew, he should have been. I'm sure he was a Jew between the ears.
There was really no reason for that witch hunt against Nixon other than what I think we addressed this earlier, I believe we touched upon, the fact that they didn't forgive him for what he did in the 50s, going after the communists when he was on the committee on the House Committee on Un-American Activities.
Well, right, absolutely. At that point, after the I'm sorry, I read that. In short, the Post wanted to keep the big secret of the case, which was the behind-the-scenes orchestration of the case by the ADL, under wraps, and now seemed to be calling to bring the trial to a rapid conclusion before the truth came out. The Post even commented editorially that, quote, "We fear that whatever may be the outcome of this trial, it will stand as a black mark against American justice for many years to come." In other words, the Post would be basically admitting here that, in their eyes anyway, the ADL stood for American justice, right? Well, which is absolutely incredulous, since it's a religious organization, so much for separation of church and state, as the Jew always likes to pronounce, which is run by a secret society. It's absolutely incredible, which is part of a secret society. As David Baxter, who was one of the defendants, later remarked, such were the remarkable words of the very paper whose own reporter had plotted with the original prosecutor to entrap the defendants and bring them to trial in Washington. Despite these concerns, Rogue seemed to intensify his efforts. Of course, he didn't care. He was a communist. He only wanted to get his enemies. There was clearly a great deal of behind-the-scenes maneuvering by the prosecutor and his backers as to how to deal with the challenge that had been presented. Since the judge never ordered the ADL's files impounded, Rogue was free to move forward. He was determined to carry the trial through to the conclusion, and he had many more witnesses to present. Author Roger Roots, he's a sort of mainstream historian, describes the course of events as follows. Day after day, the trial wore on. Page after page of publications authored by the defendants was introduced into evidence, giving rise among all in attendance to the idea that it was their writings which were really on trial. The government announced that it intended to introduce 32,000 exhibits. It became obvious that what the defendants were really prosecuted for was Jew baiting, which gave an indication of one principal source of the prosecution's support. It became one of the longest and most expensive trials in U.S. history. In essence, the trial was little more than an assault against free speech. But we see all the time that the Jew uses criminal cases and the events in history that get bad publicity in order to infringe on our rights and to convince us that our rights need to be infringed on for our safety, of course. As the trial proceeded, outspoken trial critic Senator William Langer visited defendants in jail and defied the media and its allies in the prosecution by publicly escorting defendant Elizabeth Dilling in and out of court and around Washington while she was on bail. Said Roots, quote, "The government worked with unlimited funds, unlimited personnel, and unlimited access to intelligence information. The defense had to work with mostly court-appointed lawyers who were unacquainted with the defendants and the arguments of the case. What is particularly interesting, as pointed out by a liberal historian, Glenn Jeanson, is that many of the defense attorneys were liberals, unsympathetic with the client's beliefs. But they came to see the defendant's side on a human basis, and instead of conducting a perfunctory defense, as many observers had expected, they put up a rigorous defense. Even Charles Higham, who, writing retrospectively, was an enthusiastic advocate of the trial," another Chavez Goyim, "pointed out that after 2.5 months, neither defendants nor prosecution had managed to present a satisfactory case."
Well, how could they? They don't have a case. Their case is, we don't like what these people are saying, so they shouldn't be allowed to say it.
Well, right. And ultimately, both press and public were beginning to lose interest in the case. Well, right, but in the meantime, the political opposition to the Roosevelt administration was tied up during the whole war, right, for over 3 years. At the same time, according to Paquita D. Shishmaref, the defendants had managed to survive and develop their own way of dealing with the predicament. Their physical lives were made almost impossible. They got a little to eat and were hamstrung in every way possible. But when they got into court, it was such a farce that they really just enjoyed themselves. At one point, when the prosecutor was solemnly reading off a list of names of individuals, allies of the Roosevelt administration, who had been attacked in some way by the defendants, defendant Edward James Smythe pointed out, "and Eleanor Roosevelt," well, shouted out, "and Eleanor Roosevelt," resulting in laughter from the courtroom. Smythe didn't want Mrs. Roosevelt's name to go unrecorded in the pantheon of villainy. This, by the way, was only one of the many amusing events that took place during this circus. In many respects, the sedition trial could be the basis for a Hollywood comedy, the serious and scandalous violation of the rights of the defendants notwithstanding. But this is not to suggest that the sedition trial was all a lot of merriment for the attorneys or for the defendants. Far from it. Two of the attorneys had a shot fired at them as they drove in their car. One of the defense attorneys lost a 12-year law association. Another was beaten by 5 thugs and hospitalized for 5 days. Henry Klein was harassed relentlessly, held in contempt of court for his defense of his client.
Wait,
and
someone
then
shot at a defense attorney.
I'm sorry?
These are defense attorneys that are being harassed and shot at.
Yeah, right. They're harassing the defense attorneys.
Who would have been that shot at the defense attorney?
The ADL, I'm sure. Henry Klein was harassed relentlessly, held in contempt of court for his defense of his client, and then ultimately driven from the case altogether, although the contempt of court charges were eventually overturned. In addition, strenuous efforts were made to keep the defendants who were out on bail from holding jobs during the course of the trial, a particular problem for those who were not of independent means, and that was most of them. There's a side note here. Defense attorney Ira Cohn, who represented several defendants in the Great Sedition Trial, created a stir when he declared that the trial was a Jewish plot. According to Cohn, the Anti-Defamation League has a lot more efficient Secret Service than the FBI. The ADL is responsible for this indictment and has been responsible for bringing the investigation. One defendant, Ernest Elmhurst, got a job as a head waiter in a Washington hotel in order to make ends meet during the trial. But the ADL's leading broadcasting voice, Walter Winchell, learned of Elmhurst's employment and agitated on his widely heard radio show for Elmhurst's firing, resulting in Elmhurst's dismissal. When you see stuff like that, you have to understand that there was a Jewish invasion of America, and they took it over between 1880 and 1945, right? They totally absconded America. As the trial dragged on, however, the government began to realize that its efforts were going nowhere. Roger Roots points out, the prosecution had undoubtedly expected one or more of the defendants to break and testify against the others, which is what they always wish. Not one defendant gave any indication of such an inclination, though they disagreed and some even disliked each other, they came together as a cohesive unit. David Baxter had the pleasure to learn that he was going to be severed from the trial and charges dismissed. His increasing deafness made it impossible for Baxter to have a fair trial. Baxter recalls that Judge Eicher called Baxter into his chamber, smiled, held out his hand, and said, "Go back to California and forget about it, Dave." The judge reportedly told Baxter that if Baxter and his wife wanted to buy a car to return to California, he would help, and handed Baxter a roll of gasoline coupons, which during wartime were severely rationed. Despite everything, it seems, even the judge realized what a farce the trial really was. He should have just thrown all the cases out if he wanted to be a nice guy. It was something totally unexpected that brought the trial to a halt.
I was just going to say, for a minute, I thought the judge was shaking his hand and telling him he can leave without officially dismissing the charges, and then he's going to issue a bench warrant.
Well, right.
I wouldn't be surprised if they would do that.
It was something totally unexpected that brought the trial to a halt. Judge Eicher's sudden death on November 29, 1944. The judge's demise came at a point where Rogue was not even halfway through the prosecution's case. At this point, he had brought some 39 witnesses to the stand and expected to present 67 more. The defense had not even yet begun. Defendant David Baxter later commented, reflecting on his own friendly personal experience with the judge, "That trial could have killed any judge with a Christian conscience and any semblance of fairness. I felt genuinely sorry about Judge Eicher's death." Rogue accused the defense of having effectively killed the judge by having put up such a defense that it made the judge's life and that of the prosecutor uncomfortable. Under the circumstances, it was apparent that there was no way the case could continue on a fair basis. As a consequence, after a period of legal haggling on both sides, with one defendant, Prescott Denae, actually asking for the trial to continue, determined to present his defense after having been tried and convicted in the media, a mistrial was declared. Prodded primarily by Jewish groups, Prosecutor Rogue hoped to be able to keep the case alive and set a new trial in motion. That would have been a fourth indictment, right? By the spring of 1945, the trial's chief instigator, President Roosevelt, was dead, and the war had come to a close. Rogue, however, continued to ask for delays in setting a new trial date. Since Germany had fallen, Rogue claimed, he was confident that he could find evidence in the German archives that the sedition trial defendants had been Nazi collaborators. However, according to historian Glenn Jeansom, no friend of the purported seditionists, nothing Rogue found proved the existence of a conspiracy between the German government and the defendants. Undaunted, Rogue launched a nationwide lecture tour. He's making a career out of this trial, right, this communist. Rogue launched a nationwide lecture tour that was, not surprisingly, conducted under the auspices of B'nai B'rith. The combative and loquacious Rogue, prodded by his sponsors, could not contain himself in his enthusiastic recounting of the events of the trial and of the personalities involved. And in the end, was fired by the Justice Department on October 25, 1946, for leaking information to the press. At that time, Rogue was ordered to hand over all Justice Department and FBI documents in his possession. The Justice Department had apparently decided Rogue had outlived his usefulness. Of course, we're gearing up for the Cold War, so what do we need communists in the Justice Department for? Less than a month later, District Judge Belisa Laws dismissed the charges altogether, declaring that the defendants had not received a speedy trial as guaranteed by the Constitution. Although the Justice Department appealed, the dismissal was upheld on June 30th, 1947. So they're still appealing this, right? By the U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals, the Great Sedition Trial came to a close. That's 4 years or 5 years from the original indictments in 1942 to June 30th, 1947. Even as defendant Lawrence Dennis was moved to comment, some or all may even have been guilty of conspiring to undermine the loyalty of the armed forces, but not as charged by the government. Nothing in the evidence brought out during the trial proved or even suggested that any one of the defendants was ever guilty of such a conspiracy. Except on the prosecution theory. And on that theory, opponents of President Roosevelt's pre-Pearl Harbor foreign policy and steps in foreign affairs, such as Colonel Lindbergh, Senator Staff, Senator Nye, or Senator Wheeler, and Colonel McCormick, publisher of the Chicago Tribune, would be equally guilty. Indeed, the prosecution case, according to the prosecution theory, would have been much stronger against these prominent isolationists than it ever could be against the less important defendants in the sedition trial. Many years later, it is grimly amusing to note that organized Jewish groups and Jewish newspapers attacked the Attorney General, Francis Biddle, for having failed to see the sedition trial through to the bitter end and achieve the conviction of the defendants. Lawrence Dennis wryly commented that all of this showed a great deal of ingratitude on their part. According to Dennis, it shows what a public servant gets for attempting to do the dirty work of the Jew, he didn't say that, to the satisfaction of minority pressure groups. Biddle did the best anyone in his position could do to carry out the wishes of the people behind the trial. They simply did not appreciate the difficulties of railroading to jail their political enemies without evidence of any acts in violation of the law.
Well, how disgusting is that? That he was just doing he was just doing his job. They're basically covering for him, it seems. They're running cover for him, and they're saying he was in a difficult position. Well, as we said, he should have resigned.
Well, right. This is Lawrence Dennis who's making these statements, right? He was one of the defendants, and I think that he is probably, you know, the people of the time were a lot more civil and polite than what we're accustomed to today. I mean, in our Judaized society. I think that Dennis was much more forgiving than we're accustomed to seeing, right? Dennis added a further warning for those who would allow themselves to be caught up in promoting show trials such as that which was affected in the Great Sedition Trial of 1944. What the government does today to a crackpot, so-called, Dennis said, it may do to an elder statesman of the opposition the day after tomorrow. The trial made history, Dennis said, but not as the government had planned. It made history as a government experiment which went wrong. It was a Department of Justice experiment, an imitation of a Moscow political propaganda trial. There were at least five definitive conclusions which can be drawn about this trial based upon all that is in the historical record. One, the defendants charged were largely on trial for having expressed views that were either anti-Jewish or anti-communist or both. The actions of I would say they're the same thing, right? The actions of the defendants had little or nothing to do with encouragement of dissension or insurrection within the U.S. armed forces. In short, the sedition trial was a fraud from the start. The prime movers behind the prosecution were private special interest groups representing powerful Jewish organizations, such as the Anti-Defamation League of B'nai B'rith, that were closely allied with the Roosevelt regime in power. As a consequence, high-level politicians, including the U.S. president, and bureaucrats beholden to those private interests use their influence to ensure that the police powers of the government were used to advance the demands of those private pressure groups agitating for the sedition trial. Major media voices such as the Washington Post, working with the ADL and allied with the ruling regime, were prime players in promoting and facilitating the events that led to the trial. The police powers of government can be easily abused, and innocent citizens, despite constitutional guarantees of protection, can be persecuted under color of law, their innocence notwithstanding. About a decade after the Great Sedition Trial had come to a close, the major media in America began devoting much energy to denouncing so-called anti-communist witch hunts by Senator Joseph P. McCarthy and others. The media, not to mention mainstream historians, never drew the obvious parallel with the precedent for such witch hunting that had been set by the activities of the ADL and its allies in the Roosevelt administration, who had orchestrated the sedition trial. The events of the Great Sedition Trial are a black page of American history, and little known at that. Civil libertarians should take note. It can happen here, and it did. And that's the end of our presentation on the Great Sedition.
And the Jews say, never again, never again, never again, although we know it didn't happen, what they're referring to, this could easily happen again. And in fact, these sedition trials have happened again and again and again.
Well, there were sedition trials again in the 1980s, right?
Fort Smith, Arkansas, if I'm not mistaken.
Right, that's what I'm referring to. I'm not familiar with all the details, but yes, that's Lewis. I'm trying to remember his last name. I'm sorry, I can't come up. Yes, Lewis Beam.
And Glenn Miller was there, if I recall.
Yes.
And at some Traitor. Point, we should probably expand on that, do a series on the Fort Smith.
Well, I'd like to know more about the sedition, the Fort Smith, Arkansas sedition trial. I don't know enough about it myself, right?
Absolutely. So where do we go to next? Shall we set a time?
I would like to talk about Elizabeth Dilling a little more at length, and Charles Coughlin and Ezra Pound.
All right.
And they really destroyed Ezra Pound's life also, right?
Okay.
For simply opposing the Roosevelt administration and the war.
Gerald has a number of original social justice articles, and at some point he and I will probably be scanning those in the near future, and we will most certainly make them available on the MK Christogena site, and we can discuss the social justice.
Well, right. They'd be a great boon to the site, because that's something I don't see around. I might be wrong, but I haven't seen any of those issues online.
And they're probably not widely available. I don't think if Jews come across those at a yard sale, they go out of their way to destroy them. They buy them and burn them, or they just steal them.
Well, right. And Charles Coughlin, I mean, I'm no big fan of Catholics, right? Not by any means. But he was a prominent and popular voice against Roosevelt policies. He knew that Roosevelt was a communist. He knew what time it was and what was going on. And they actually, he loved his retirement pension and the church more than he loved the truth, right? Because they were able to use that as a wedge to silence him.
All right, then. So we will resume in several weeks.
Okay. Praise Yahweh.
Yahweh bless. Thank you.
Yahweh bless.